Black English used to be a creole, specifically Gullah, sometimes known as Geechee talk. The idea is that where Black English is spoken today in the South, it used to be that the ancestors of those Black people who are speaking Black English today would have been speaking Gullah, that Gullah would have been much more widespread. Today, Gullah is just spoken on the Sea Islands off of South Carolina and a little bit inland. But the idea is that that is a relic situation of a much more widespread language before. So that would be an interesting history. And it's kind of a variation on the Africa. This time, instead of it being Africa, it's that Black English is a watered-down version of something that was once exotically different from standard English, like Gullah. So it's one of those ideas that you want to believe. I remember when I was first exposed to it, I thought, isn't it nice to imagine that I had ancestors who spoke, you know, not only African languages, but more immediately here in the United States, I thought they spoke Geechee, something very different, and my heritage and blah, blah, blah. But the fact is, if you look into the historical sources, it doesn't wash. You look and you look for evidence that Gullah was once spoken further, and the evidence just isn't there. Now, of course, you don't find evidence in the form of someone in North Carolina saying in 1860, we do not speak Gullah here any more than we will in 2004. A lot of it is a matter of the fact that the Gullah evidence never comes up. No one mentions it. It never shows up in any depiction of speech of Black people. And so you start to wonder. And there have been some really clever ways of trying to get at this. So, for example, there was a time when it was fashionable to suppose that one was supposed to first free slaves and then send them back to the land where they belonged, or just somewhere other than the United States. So, in the 1800s, there were large numbers of Black people who were resettled in places such as Nova Scotia, big surprise, most of them didn't like it, and the Dominican Republic, that worked out better, and Liberia, that we all know did not work out very well at all. All of those places are ones where Black people at the time, when supposedly all or most or even a good deal of Black people were speaking Gullah instead of Black English, would have been moved somewhere else, where presumably if we went to those places, we'd find them still speaking something like this Gullah. The idea is that everybody else in the United States, after emancipation, had more contact with whites and more education, and so the dialect diluted into Black English, which is closer to the standard. But we would think that if that sort of thing didn't happen in Liberia, or if it didn't happen in the Dominican Republic in particular, then we would see a preservation. And the Dominican Republic is particularly interesting because, of course, the language there is Spanish. So the idea would be that there'd be no standard English to move to. And there's a tiny peninsula, a peninsula that's literally about as thin as a pencil, except that thousands of people live on it, where there are rather isolated, poor Black people who speak a kind of English, and they're surrounded by Spanish, and so the English can't bleed into standard English. And there have been studies done of them, waiting to hear them speak Gullah, but they really just sound kind of like American Black people. Or there's a Liberian dialect that's kind of like that. The Nova Scotia dialect is like that. So it doesn't seem to really work. Or there are other things. You just look in places where you would expect it. Scott Joplin, the ragtime composer, lived from 1868 to 1917. And he, near the end of his life, wrote an opera. It was called Treemonisha. Scott Joplin was Black, by the way. And he wrote this opera. And he wrote it about life in his small Texas Black town when he was a young child. So we're talking about post-emancipation Black America way down south in the 1860s and 1870s. And he's writing about poor, notably unsophisticated people. Whole opera. Isn't it interesting that Scott Joplin never has any of those people speaking any kind of Gullah or Geechee? That's where you would expect it to be. They speak a kind of stylized Black English. And it's not that you wouldn't put the Gullah in an opera because people wouldn't understand it, because then you have the play that Porgy and Bess was based on, written by Dorothy and DeBose Hayward. And the play is, frankly, a difficult read today because it's written in this kind of Geechee-ized English. And so the idea was to show that these people were kind of speaking a different language, even though you could understand them. So where is that in Treemonisha? And there are all sorts of things like that where no one ever mentions what would have been a prominent phenomenon. If you study the history of any real Creole-speaking country, you don't have to look for evidence that the slaves spoke something else. If you're studying Haiti, you know there was Haitian Creole. It's not hidden. You don't have to look for clues. It's there. Always people are saying the slaves have a certain way of talking. You are going to need this dictionary before you go to the plantation, etc. Here in the United States, that doesn't exist. There's no dictionary of slave talk. There is no grammatical sketch of the speech of the Negroes for those who were interested. Nothing like that, some yellowing book that you find at the archives. So the conclusion, I think, and some people would disagree with me, but that's too bad. In my opinion, I don't think that there is any evidence that Gullah was once spoken much beyond where it is now. And so again, Black English is not as exotic in that way as people think. Where do the differences come from then? There is something exotic, but ironically, most of it is from Great Britain. And it's very counterintuitive. We do not associate the African-American experience here in the United States, especially after the 1960s, with people in northern Great Britain who are on TV shows like The Darling Buds of May and Are You Being Served? But really, those are the parallels. So, for example, habitual B. It's interesting. Ralph Cramden doesn't say that. So it's not something that happens in all non-standard dialects of English. But what that is, actually, is Hiberno English. It's Irish English. I can read you a sentence, even when I be round there with friends, I be scared. That's not the south side of Chicago. That is an Irishman, believe it or not. Very often, Irish English speakers listen to talks in academia about Black English and say, you know, this is just like what I heard at home. And not the slang. Remember, the slang, we're going to put all that in a box, and we're going to take that box, and we're going to put it here. That's not of concern. We're going to push that off the table. It's the sounds and the grammar that we're interested in. So, no, there's no fishizzle in Ireland, but it's about the sounds and the grammar. Or if somebody says, oh, it's somebody at the door, for there's somebody at the door. It's somebody at the door over there. In Cornwall English, we'll have my made-up Cornwall accent again. You could say, test someone to the door. That's how you would say, there's someone at the door. It's somebody at the door. They have the tis. So that it usage is something that you can find in England. And in general, and there's no exaggeration, if you look at a dialect atlas of the non-standard dialects of English in Great Britain, you see Black English winking at you page after page after page. It's obvious that not just some and not just half, but most of the differences between Black English and standard English are, of all things, things that arose on that windswept island with bad food. Specifically, it was people speaking those dialects who were brought to the New World and worked alongside these Black slaves. Often the indentured servants were essentially slaves themselves. There was a great deal of what we might call miscegenation, and that of course meant more mingling of the kinds of dialects. And there were many of the plantation owners themselves were not exactly from the cream of society, because once more there was no air conditioning. And that's almost not a joke. Why in the world would you go work your butt off in Alabama rather than stay home where you are? It's hot in Alabama, and there's no fan. So, if you went there, you probably were not a coddled standard English speaker. So, there are all sorts of things like that. So, what is Black English, then? You know, what exactly is it? It's not quite that Black English is a grand combination of British dialects. I say this, and the British impact is quite extensive. It's dominant even. But still, Black Americans don't sound like Miss Brahms and Mrs. Slocum on Are You Being Served? If by any chance any of you have not seen that show and don't know what I'm talking about, I warmly recommend, in addition to all of the sources on language that I have in the glossary for this set, that you watch every episode of this silly and delightful, heartwarming show. Of course, only to listen to the non-standard British accents. In any case, it's not only that, because clearly there's a difference. For example, there is no non-standard British dialect that as She My Sister. Or to the extent that there is one, one analyst has found it kind of mumbled among a few speakers in this one town in a certain mood when the planets were aligned in a certain way. Okay, and that's a slight exaggeration, but only in that one town with this one dialect, and it's clearly very rare. It is not part of how English usually works in Britain. And then on the other hand, there are other things like why you didn't call me. If you're inclined, listen to African American kids on the street, or if you know some better, just listen. And so, why you didn't call me? Well, instead of the why didn't you call me, not making that inversion, that's not British English either. There's some differences. What that is that we see that these are slight simplifications, just slight, not enough to make you think, goodness, a Creole in Harlem, but just slight little shavings around the edges. And the reason for that is that this was a dialect created by Africans who had already learned other languages natively. So apparently they learned English pretty darn well. But every now and then they shaved off a corner. Why didn't you go to the store? Why you didn't go to the store makes just as much sense to my ear, maybe partly because of having grown up hearing the dialect. It actually kind of sounds better. Why didn't you go to the store? Why do you have to switch it like that? It's perverted, really. And that kind of twisting of subject and auxiliary is actually very rare outside of Europe. So why you didn't go to the store? Well, why not say that? That's nice. Leaving out the verb to be is something that's very common when you are learning a language and trying to kind of shave off some of the corners. You don't have to have it, and so therefore maybe you might leave that out, especially since in English contraction is sort of a bridge to that. So she's my sister, the is already kind of truncated. Well, she, my sister. That can happen. So what it is slightly mediated by non-native acquisition by Africans. There are one or two aspects of the sound system that can be treated as that same thing. So Black English is, for one thing, it's not just the slang. Another thing that it's not is an African language. I don't think that it began as a Creole language. It's just a non-standard but not substandard dialect of English. To the extent that it seems at all exotic compared to even a North Country British dialect, that's because it shows slight signs of the fact that the people who created it were people who were past their critical acquisition phase and were no longer capable of learning a language perfectly upon hearing it for just a little while. And so every now and then, some corners are shaved off. Not enough to render it anything like a Creole, though. And even though some corners have been shaved off, it's, to make a really sloppy analogy, grown some new corners. And so, for example, the use of habitual be, there are other complications that have happened. So, as a result, Black English can be described as a semi-creole of regional English dialects of the United Kingdom. And it stands in the same relationship to Standard English as Standard English stands to Old English. Because as we've seen, Standard English is a little more shaved down than it should be. Where are hithers and thithers and withers? Well, Black English takes that a slight step further. But basically, Black English is English.
Lecture 33, Language Death, The Problem.
This series has been about a process of growth, of mixture, of rebirth, and even extravagance. Languages go further than they should, but they just do it, and they come out bruised, sadder, and wiser. But there's another part of the history of language, and that is decline and extinction. This is just as with flora and fauna. There is a serious crisis in terms of how many species are being exterminated in the world today. And for related reasons, there is what many would consider a crisis in terms of how many languages are ceasing to be spoken. And what it comes down to is that As soon as a generation of speakers are not using an indigenous language, and they're not passing that language on to the next generation, i.e. their children, then the language is on its way to disappearing completely. And it's important to realize that all it takes is one generation, because the way a language is passed down is to children. Once you're 12, 13-ish, 14-ish, your abilities to master a language quickly and flawlessly start to decline. And after you're an adult, unless you are some combination of lucky and obsessive, you really cannot acquire a language in anything approaching perfection. So the way that the ability to do what I'm doing now in this particular language is passed on is when you are tiny. Once a society goes through a generation where the language is not being passed on to the tiny, then the language cannot breathe again. So that means that if you meet a society where very old people are speaking the language in great numbers, so people losing their teeth are chattering along in the language in the dozens or the hundreds, but then middle-aged people do not speak the language, then the language is still in trouble, because languages are not usually passed on from people in their 80s to children. The people in their 80s can help, but usually it's the primary caretaker who does this. And so, once a language skips a generation, chances are that it is going to disappear. And what's important with language is that when it disappears, we are not talking about the Ozymandias notion of there being some sort of relic to reconstruct what the past used to be like from. If a language disappears and it hasn't been put into writing, and remember that writing only came along at 11:08 p.m. if language has existed for 24 hours, and remember that most languages in the world, i.e. the vast majority, are not written in any serious way, then once the language is gone, it really is gone. There were once creatures in this world that were much taller and bigger than buildings. We know them as dinosaurs. You can see the skeletons in the museums. And we often reify these skeletons into something different. We think, well, there is a dinosaur skeleton. And there are times when you have to look at those skeletons, which are dwarfing practically the room, and think, that lived. That had skin and muscles. It mated, it made noise, it messed things up, it had emotions, it went to the bathroom. That was a living thing. Now, we can know a whole lot about dinosaurs based on finding those bones, and there's so many massively clever ways that we can reconstruct what these animals were like from extrapolating from the bones. But with a language, it's not like that. If somebody is doing what I'm doing now, but it's a language that is not written and is never used in CD series or DVD series for the teaching company, then it's just gone, as a great many languages throughout human history surely have been. It's just a mouthful of air, and if it's not recorded, there's no way to recover it. If we find an ancient skeleton, we have no way to reconstruct from looking at its hyoid bone and the cut of its jaw and how its teeth were, what language it spoke. So when a language is dead, it is dead. So that's the nature of the crisis. And the fact is that languages have always died to an extent. It's not that this crisis that we have today has no kind of qualitative precedent. Languages have died when all of their speakers were exterminated for some reason. Or more frequently, it's that speakers of a language are subordinated by some group and gradually switch to the language of the dominant. So we've seen that in Indo-European, the totality of Indo-European has included a great many languages that are now dead, such as Hittite in Turkey and Tocharian, the language connected with the Caucasian mummies in China that we talked about. Those are dead languages, and I don't think that generally there's an organ chord of sorrow when we think about Hittite. Oh, what a tragedy that nobody speaks Hittite. We think, well, nobody does. We never knew anybody who did, and it's nice to have some scholars studying Hittite, but we have other languages we can speak. So it did happen. And even in the Eurasian language, even in the Eurasian region alone, there are dozens of languages that we know have died. Some of them recorded, a great many of them not at all, or in just, say, a word list or two, or an inscription that says something like, "This is my sheep." But that doesn't give you a sense of what the whole language was like. So it's common. And the process accelerated with the Neolithic Revolution. As I've said before, it used to be that human beings were small hunter-gatherer groups patching the globe, only knowing each other when they happened to be close to each other. But once we had certain groups spreading and taking over large portions of land and in the process subjugating other people, then you had a situation where certainly a great many languages were being exterminated. So there are estimates that there were probably tens of thousands of languages at a time in this original hunter-gatherer situation, and yet today we've got 6,000. Now, if you look at the countries of the world and think that there must be 200 or 300 languages, then when I say 6,000, that seems like a lot. But, of course, 6,000 is just a fraction of what could have been 50,000 or 100,000. So, in general, migrators' languages tend to extinguish the languages of the people that they encounter. And there are probably fewer languages today than at any other point in human history since humans had migrated extensively enough to more or less cover the planet. But the process today is occurring at a much more accelerated rate. And an interesting statistic is that today, 96% of the world's people speak one of the 20 most spoken languages. Now, in the vast majority of cases, they also speak one of the many other languages, but they also are speaking one of the big 20. The big 20 are Chinese, English, Spanish, Hindi, Arabic, Bengali, Russian, Portuguese, Japanese, German, French, Punjabi, Javanese, believe it or not, Bihari, you probably won't believe that because you probably haven't heard of it. Most people haven't. Italian, Korean, Telugu, Tamil, Marathi, and, interesting, Vietnamese is one of them. So those are the big 20. And pretty much everybody on Earth speaks one of those, which is dangerous in terms of the others because as life and reality tend to have it, if you're speaking one of the big ones, there's quite a chance that a generation that you sire or a generation that that generation sires is going to switch to only that one. And that's especially the case the smaller your indigenous language is. And so, according to one estimate, we will only have 10% of the languages that we have today in the year 2100. And so in roughly a century, we will lose about 5,500 languages as spoken ones. And that is sobering. It's also been said that a language on Earth dies somewhere every 2 weeks. And so we're speaking English and it keeps going, but imagine if this just vanished, if there was a 215-year-old woman and she was the last speaker of English and it had never been written down except for one shard of the Bible and something scratched on the back of a Bazooka Joe wrapper, which of course is redundant because the Bazooka Joe wrapper would be in English, but you take my point. And then she dies, her last breath and her last word is something like Bosco, and then that's it. That is happening to one language every 2 weeks. And so, it's important to remember that we're talking about a great diversity here. So for every relatively big language you know of, you should imagine that there are a whole bunch of languages rather like that that you would have no reason to have ever heard of. So there is Vietnamese, but then we talked about that language, Trao. Trao is one of a bunch of languages with names like Palawang and Hre and Bahnar that no one has any reason to know unless you happen to be in those places. Or there's Zulu and there's Xhosa or Xhosa. And those are Bantu languages that we hear a lot about because of South Africa, because of Nelson Mandela, because of Miriam Makeba. But then there are a whole bunch of other Bantu languages like Sotho and Ikalanga and all sorts of languages with names that sound kind of like that, where chances are we're never going to hear much about them here. Persian in Iran is a variation on a theme, And then there are a whole bunch of other languages like Farazandi and Zaza, and languages whose names tend to sound kind of like a veil on a woman or something like that. And they're spoken by small groups. We'll never meet any of them. Lately, we hear more than I ever thought we would about one of that gang that is Pashto, and that's because of our adventures in Afghanistan. But before this Afghanistan adventure began, I think most of us probably had never heard of Pashto, nor do most of us have any reason to know much about it. So there are many, many, many languages in the world. So the extent of what we're seeing is such that, as I have mentioned, there used to be about 300 Native American languages spoken in the continental United States. Four centuries ago, it was about 300. Today, a third of those languages are spoken by no one. Some of them were tabulated as grammars in their dictionaries. Some of them, there's only a word list taken down by somebody half drunk sitting in a glade who didn't like Indians or something like that. And that's all that we've got. Then, of the remaining two-thirds of them, only a handful are being passed down to new generations. And beyond that handful, the languages are generally spoken by very old people. And by old, I don't mean hale and hearty at 72 with a bit of arthritis, but I mean people who are 92, 93, and unlikely to be with us much longer, and even less likely to want to concentrate on teaching a child an extremely complicated language. And so that means that those languages will be dead soon. Australia was home to just about as many languages, and very few of those languages are being passed on to children. There was a language of Tasmania, which was completely exterminated and left behind only occasional fragments. We will never know exactly what happened in terms of that Tasmanian language, because nobody recorded it before it was extinct. I had an interesting experience recently. I was looking at various traits of languages in Indonesia. And Indonesia has all of these islands. And you might guess that in Indonesia, that these islands would be home to languages. And in fact, most of the islands are home to several languages. I was trying to make some general statements about some of the languages in some of these places and found that most of them have not been described in any full way, and that a lot of them are endangered. So, for example, there's an island, Sulawesi, which is shaped vaguely like somebody dancing, if you have a kind of sick imagination. It used to be called Celebes. You might be familiar with Sulawesi from the fact that there's a coffee that Starbucks often sells, which is Sulawesi. It's that. Sulawesi is jam-packed with languages and fascinating ones, too. Only a handful of those have been described in any serious way. Otherwise, they're word lists. And what kind of description of a language are we talking about when what we know about it is how to say take, son, boy, ball, hello, goodbye, dying language, etc.? That's not the language. We don't know the grammar. So the usual situation there is that. And languages like Indonesian, or in some cases Portuguese, or in some cases a Creole of this or a Creole of that, are threatening a lot of these indigenous languages, and some of them are clearly going to disappear without ever having been recorded in any real way. So what happens to a language when it's dying is a question. Can you see signs of it when it's happening? And the answer is yes. What happens when a language starts to die is that it starts to revert through the pigeon stage down into dust. So instead of seeing a language be at a pigeon stage and build up into a full language, it ends up devolving and passing on its way down that pigeon stage and then becoming just a splat on the floor. What happens is that when the language stops being used regularly, it starts being spoken in a way that shaves off the fascinating machinery that defines human language. So it starts to revert to this pigeon-like stage. So, for example, the Cayuga language, that's one of the grand 300 Native American languages, its vocabulary started to shrink. By the 1980s, it was spoken mostly by very old people, and it had a word for leg, it had a word for foot, and it had a word for eye. But it didn't have a word for thigh. It didn't have a word for ankle, didn't have a word for cheek. So it had the basics. You know, you can't talk if you can't say something about your leg hurting. But, you know, you don't necessarily need thigh. You can just point to it. So a language is kind of luxurious to have a word for thigh. No thigh, no ankle, no cheek. The original word for enter was no longer used. They were just using go. That's nice. So you do go into a room. You could also enter the room. That's a nice little detail, nice nuance, a nice antimacassar on the chair. But that's gone. So in other words, it's getting more and more like Rusinorsk and less like a real language, such as Cayuga the way it was before. Or take suffixes. Hablo, hablas, habla, hablamos, habláis, hablan. That is the bugbear of the learner. It's also the bugbear of the person who is losing their language. So in Spanish, if you want to say that you will speak, you might want to say, voy a hablar. I'm going to speak. Because that's a little easier than remembering that little ending and saying, I will speak, hablaré. That's kind of a laziness that we're all probably familiar with to some extent if we've tried to master an inflectional language. Dying language speakers, i.e. speakers of a dying language, not people who are in the process of expiring, tend to avoid prefixes and suffixes of that kind because the separate words tend to be easier to remember. So there's a language in Central America called Pipil, and there's a future marker, which is a suffix, S. It's an ending, S. But today, speakers tend to use the go verb and say, I'm going to speak, instead of bothering with tacking on that S and dealing with the complications that come from how it sometimes changes and things like that. So the complicated parts start to flake away. Then there's just the whole notion of articulateness. There are levels of language. There are ways of using it well. And it's not only based on big fancy words. It's based on just how smartly you can express yourself, how deftly. Many Native American languages, as we've seen, what we think of as a sentence is a single word. And this varies even within the language how much you do that. And where you do that and when is part of speaking the language with nuance. You have to really speak the language to know when to come up with one of those word sentences and when to actually express with separate words. And so, for example, in Cayuga, one way to say she has a big house is to use this one big word pronounced roughly konotsowane. And what that means is it big houses her. Like, it's bothering me. A Pennsylvania Dutch person might say it wonders me instead of I wonder or it's marvelous. And to say she has a big house, you say that the state of having a big house is put upon her. And so it big houses her. That's how you say it. Now that to us sounds like some sort of mental twist. But in Cayuga, that is quite normal. But big surprise, in Cayuga today, speakers of the dying version say she has a big house, or they say her house is big. That's how you would actually render it word for word. They don't have the konosawane. That nuance is lost, so it's becoming a more elementary language. So the generation after the one that speaks the language on this level, where it is the language, but it's not the language as it used to be, it's the old gray mare, the generation after that will speak a few words, and they might have some phrases, but if what you're being exposed to is this, for one thing, your parents or the people who are raising you probably aren't speaking it all the time. Chances are somebody doesn't speak something all the time that they can't really express themselves in. Chances are that person is speaking English most of the time or some other language. So you're not going to hear it that much. And even if you did, you're getting this kind of weak signal. And so your signal is going to be even weaker still. So if you're listening to that kind of Cayuga, and it's something that you're hearing very occasionally, then you are not going to speak Cayuga at all. And then certainly when you have a child, many years after you not learned Cayuga, you're not going to pass on any Cayuga words to that child. That child will be lucky to have two words of Cayuga. And that's, of course, not a language at all. Now, this is something that is often exemplified through looking at what we might think of as exotic languages like Cayuga, but we can actually see analogs to this happening all the time in our immediate lives. You can scratch the surface of the way many immigrants' children speak the language of their parents, and you can see that actually they're not speaking the language the way their parents did. And on the folk level, often it's thought that it's that they don't know as many words. That's really only the beginning. It's the structure that's melting away quite naturally because these kids are speaking English all the time. And so, a very good example of this is I had a girlfriend about 4,000 years ago, and she had been born in Germany. And she had come to the United States at 6. Her German was still fluent. She had a grandmother who would come every summer, or she would go visit the grandmother every summer. The grandmother spoke not a lick of English, and she had a full relationship with the grandmother. And she had often spent time in Germany. She had been a waitress in Germany for the summer. And so she spoke fluent German. No doubt about that. Where she and her brother visited once, and they would speak German when they didn't want anybody to understand what they were saying. For some reason, with the brother, that included saying, "So where are we going?" I never quite understood why that was a secret sentence, but that was what they did. So, she spoke German, but it was around that time that, because I'm clinically insane, I decided that I needed to know German for no particular reason. And I taught myself at that point well enough to participate in this "where are we going" business and to understand it if it was spoon-fed to me. And I could read it, but really, when you're dealing with knowing a language, it's dealing with it in real life. And what was interesting about this woman's German was that once I got to a certain point, I realized that although she certainly spoke the language, she didn't speak it the way a native German would, and it wasn't just that she probably didn't know the word for your fourth toe on your left foot. For one thing, all of us are familiar with how you can have a great book knowledge of a language, then you go to the country and you have this feeling that people are talking too fast. Well, it's not that there are any people who for some reason talk too fast. We English speakers talk pretty quickly too, but it's just that you're not used to the subtleties of the accent and the sound system. Spend a couple of weeks or, you know, a month at the longest, and you start finding that you actually start to understand what people are saying more because you've got this American accent out of your head that you're expecting everything to be said in. So I noticed that when I traveled to Germany with this woman that I had a hard time understanding what German people were saying. If they had all just written it down, I would have gotten it. But having it fired at me live, you know, while I was jet-lagged, you know, it's always about potatoes or going to the bathroom, I had a hard time understanding what was being said. I could always understand everything that the woman said, and we were in various social settings, and it was interesting. They were all speaking German, but for some reason hers to me was as clear as a bell. The reason was because she spoke German with an American accent, so she was rendering the language in a way that I was familiar with. Everybody else was speaking it with a true German accent. Now, she wasn't speaking it with a horrible German accent. It wasn't "Ich bin ein Berliner," but it was enough that I had no trouble understanding her. And then there were other things. I started to notice that if she was presented with a passage of adult German using sophisticated sentence structure, and not the word for the fourth toe on the left foot, but words along the lines of association, words along the lines of mere, the sorts of things that you don't expect a three-year-old to use. Three-year-olds don't talk about mere association, nor do six-year-olds. I noticed that she was kind of weak in that realm, which is what you would expect if your actual use of the language stopped when you were 6, and from then on you had a casual relationship with relatives once a year, but you had no reason to grow into a more adult version of the language. So she spoke fluent German, and that was wonderful, but it was also a slightly atrophied German. It was what a linguist would call immigrant German. And more to the point, if she married someone who spoke German exactly that way, and they were in the United States, unless they made a really superhuman effort, chances are they would speak English quite a bit around that kid, and the kid would hear English the minute the kid started leaving the house for any length of time. And in the meantime, what the kid would get is mostly English, some German, but a German that's actually kind of fragmentary, and the kid would reproduce an even lesser German, and so on. So we're seeing that in this country with Chinese. We're seeing it in this country with Russian. Russian is a massively complex language. Depending on when the Russian immigrant child comes over, their Russian is full of not just variations, and I've emphasized in this course that what we often think of as mistakes are just variations, but there are mistakes. Like on one of these sets, we have to change when I confused bought and brought. It is a problem that I have in my brain. My mother used to get on me about it when I was 3. To me, bought and brought are the same. I know intellectually. I'd never make the mistake in writing. But if I'm speaking casually, to me, I brought it at the store for 3 cents sounds great. I bought the chair over to my mother and put it down sounds great. That is my sickness. That is not variation. That is a mistake. It's something that I should be corrected out of. In the same way, we would be finding in kids like this girlfriend's and her husband's mistakes, a German with things that really weren't right, in the same way as in many immigrant Russians' kids, what they're making are mistakes in Russian, and these things just kind of continue. So, it is a situation where a language really just gives up the ghost. That's what goes on. But there is an issue that we might want to consider, which is exactly why we should care about this. It's this guilty kind of question that some of us might have. Because, of course, the PC version of this is that diversity is disappearing and we must have diversity. But if we kind of think beyond that, we might want to ask in our spare time, in this particular case, is the diversity really so wonderful? So, for example, the story of the Tower of Babel is generally considered something of a tragedy. It was a dirty trick played, the idea being to keep people from understanding each other. Would it be so terrible if everybody spoke one language? And, of course, some of us find foreign languages neat, and I'm one of them. So I think, well, that'd be kind of boring if you got off the plane and people were talking like this. But, you know, people have different interests. I don't care about football. Most people seem to. So I can't take that as evidence of policy that I would like there to be lots of languages. For many people, I think it'd be perfectly fine if everybody spoke English when you got off of the plane, because you wouldn't have these communication problems. The UN wouldn't have to spend all this money. We wouldn't have to waste time in all of these courses teaching languages badly anyway. We wouldn't misinterpret people because of their accents and their mistakes. It's an effort to learn to see the full human being underneath mistakes in a language you're used to hearing spoken properly. I wouldn't have gone to Russia and asked for apricots and been given a cup of coffee. None of that would have happened if we really just had one language. Suppose it wasn't English. Suppose the language was Chow. Still, just one language. And so, we have to realize that the situation we have now is really just kind of an accident. The truth is that we have so many languages not because we are hardwired in our brains or because of natural selection for diversity or anything like that. I've also heard it said that it's advantageous that we have different languages because then groups can differ themselves from each other and then better be positioned to trust one another and form bonds with one another and thrive through the benefits of cooperation. Hogwash. The reason that we have all these different languages is because once people speaking the first language were in separate places, what our mouths and our brains tend to do to a language gradually over time was different in each place. And that is why you have English and Japanese. And that's a rather faceless process. And so language changes like a game of operator, and you start out whispering in someone's ear. Frogs are sometimes ugly. And then after you go like 9 times down the line, what comes out is something like, I was not involved with that woman, or something like that. That is how language change works. But the fact is, we might say that we want to care about losing all these languages for the simple reason that languages, as I hope we've seen in this series, are really, really interesting. And if all there was English, then I wouldn't have been able to talk about things like evidential markers and clicks. So there is that part. There's also an argument that many would make that language is tied to cultures. And as I've said, I think that that argument tends to be exaggerated, but it's not completely wrong. When a language dies, chances are that a culture has died with it. Languages can also tell us a great deal about the human mind. And in terms of what language can tell us about the mind, we do need to see all of the different kinds of languages. And each one that dies may deprive us of a chance to find, as it were, that medicinal plant with some sort of valuable property or something that will tell us something more general about all of the plants, i.e. all of languages and all of minds. So it's a complex issue, and as such, we're going to continue it in the next lecture.
Lecture 34, Language Death, Prognosis.
The language death issue is not just an abstract one. There are movements around the world to revive a number of languages that are in danger of extinction. These are thriving efforts to pass these languages along to new generations. Irish Gaelic is one of the most famous of these movements, and there's another one for Irish Gaelic's fellow Celtic language, Welsh. There is another Celtic language, which is spoken across the English Channel in France. That's called Breton, and there is a Breton preservation movement. And there are also language preservation movements that are particularly well known for Maori, the Polynesian language of New Zealand, and Hawaiian, which is another Polynesian language closely related to Maori, spoken in Hawaii. Some people involved in these efforts are more optimistic than others. And there is a question as to whether we can maintain all 6,000 of the world's languages. And one might want to posit there are two extremes. One is that everybody in the world speaks nothing but English. The other is that we preserve all 6,000 of the world's languages, even though most people on Earth will continue to control one of the top 20 alongside. As so often, the truth about this probably lies somewhere in the middle in terms of realism. The chance that everybody in the world is going to speak only English is very slim. If it looks that way to us, that's partly because as American English speakers, most of us, we are not as deeply familiar with the ordinariness of bilingualism and multilingualism as many people are. English will be the top language, the H language, the high language, the public language for increasing numbers of people, but that doesn't mean that languages spoken by tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or millions of people tightly tied to a culture, to a way of life, to even perhaps a worldview, are going to disappear in favor of that language. Languages exist alongside each other. So I could be a Pollyanna, but I don't think Finnish is in danger of disappearing. I don't think Koreans are going to stop speaking Korean. It seems highly unlikely, if only because of habit. Now that Koreans do speak Korean and Finns do speak Finnish, precisely what would allow them to stop it? So I don't think we have to worry too much about that. But as for maintaining all 6,000 of the languages in the world today as living, speaking, spoken varieties, I think that that is as unlikely as that English is going to truly take over the world. There are many obstacles, and they're large ones. And even if one wants to avoid being a professional pessimist, too much optimism in a case like this seems somewhat quixotic, I think. It's been said that once there's a revival movement for a language, the language is already dead. Now, that was spit in the eye. But there is some truth to the notion. For example, there's the issue of status. Often, people who speak an indigenous language that is not written don't think of it as real because it isn't written and it isn't used in wider communications. So very often, linguists and anthropologists and maybe missionaries for other purposes are more interested in preserving the language than the speakers themselves. And it's easy for us to think, oh, the poor benighted speakers who don't realize the treasure of what their language is. But we have to imagine that the language that we grew up speaking is one that we never see on the page. This is almost as difficult as laying in your bed and imagining what it really must feel like to fly. Really step out of your body. Step out of your mind and imagine that you just talk your native language. It's not written. Nobody who isn't a whole lot like you speaks it. And you just, that's your language. Then you grow up with this other one that's written and that there's Dickens in it and Sanford and Son is in it, etc. It's there. It's documented. Now, can't you imagine that you might feel that the language that you only spoke, where when you hear the word for dog in it, you don't see letters in your head, you just think of the creature, might not seem real because all it is your throat and air? I can understand that. And so, whether or not that's correct, it's a very easy impression to have. It's perhaps even defensible on an advanced philosophical level. And that means that sometimes you're telling people to preserve something that they don't really think is worthwhile. And remember, you've only got one generation. You've got 20 years. And as we all know, time passes. I found the first gray hair on my head this morning. So, then there's another problem, which is urbanization. As people move from the countryside to the city more and more, as people are chased from the countryside to the city, people are driven from hardscrabble lives in the countryside to seeking their fortune in the city. Whatever reason you come to the city, the problem is that in the city, generally there's some big fat language spoken. Now, you, out wherever you were, you spoke something interesting and exotic. But then you come to the city, and the only people you can use that language with are the people who happen to come along with you or people who happen to have gotten there before you. So there might be a club. There might be a neighborhood. You might have some friends. But you're going to have to learn that big thing. Then if you marry, the chances that the person you marry are going to speak your 1,000-speaker language are very, very small. And if she speaks something else, what you two are going to speak with each other is going to be that big fat language, probably. And then if you have kids, that's what you're going to be in. You're going to talk to them mostly in. And even if you have a relatively insular family and you actually manage to pass on not one, but two indigenous languages to these kids while you're living in a tall building and only visiting the countryside occasionally, what are the chances that the kids are going to know those two languages or even one of them well? And then what are the chances that they're going to meet someone else who speaks that language when they get married? And if they get married to somebody who speaks another one, are they going to, and so on and so on. So that means that urbanization tends to promulgate the larger languages that are used in that context over the smaller languages. And to the extent that people are moved to go to big metropolises, that spells language death for the languages that are not spoken there. There's a very intelligent work on language death called Vanishing Voices by Suzanne Romaine and Daniel Nettle. And its thesis is that we must create conditions for people to be able to stay on their land instead of going to the cities, because once you go to the city, your indigenous language is probably dead. Only keeping people on their land would do it. And of course, here you run up against the idea that you're going to tell someone, don't move to the city and try to make more money and try to see movies with big billboards, because you should stay out here in the country and speak that language that you think of as a mouthful of air that I think of as exotic because I had time to get a PhD and sit around and think about things like that. That's hard. So it's a question, and it's not a pleasant question. Then there's another problem, which is that by the time the language is dying, often, most of the people who are speaking it are no longer using the full vocabulary or the grammar anyway. So once you can say, oh dear, this language is on its way, already there's this slightly pigeonized version of it being spoken. So that means that even if you revive it, then the version of it that's being passed on is highly abbreviated. And so you have to decide, what does it mean to pass the language on if the conditions are such that you cannot pass on the language in anything like its full vibrancy? Now, of course, if the language is written, then you can go to books and find out what was decaying. But the chances that a language that has a long written tradition is going to be dying that way are slim. It happens, but usually the language that's dying wasn't written much anyway, except by outsiders who consider the language exotic, such as linguists, etc. But that's not real writing. If what you've got is a dictionary and a grammatical description and a translation of parts of the New Testament and then a couple of other things scratched on paper bags, that's not a written language. That's just a spoken language, and that's not enough to revive it. So you've got problems like that. Then there's another problem in these situations, which is discussed oddly rarely among language revivalists, but which I believe is a genuine issue. And it's not a matter of pessimism. It's not a matter of being a Cassandra. It's not a matter of having inadequate faith in people. It's a matter of hard-nosed, thoroughly compassionate, but hard-nosed reality. And that is that languages are hard. And the fact is that If you are trying to revive a language, what you're talking about is not pouring water on something and having sea monkeys appear. You're talking about teaching people how to speak a language and not read it and not be able to use it on a junior semester abroad. So we're not talking about my uncle is a lawyer, but my aunt has a spoon and all those stupid sentences that you have to learn. The idea is that you're supposed to be speaking this language a lot. And that is a hard thing to teach people, especially because we run up against something that we have learned in this series, which is that the languages that are dying tend to be small and indigenous, and those languages tend to be the hardest languages in the world. So it's very rare that we have a language dying that is as user-friendly as a Spanish. Spanish is hard enough. But not only is Spanish kind of like English, but Spanish is, you know, rather approachable in many ways. I always tell people, especially for an English speaker, if you want to learn a language and you're over about 12, go for Spanish. That's the one that will beat you up the least. Dying languages aren't like Spanish. They are not like Dutch. They're languages where they were rarely learned by outsiders, and they got very, very complicated. This includes the Celtic languages. People have not been learning Irish Gaelic as a second language until very recently. This was an in-group language. A language like Maori was an in-group language. So here we come, and we want to learn them, but these are languages that were designed to be learned by humans at a stage when they could not control their bowels, an unconscious learning. Then all of a sudden, there you are with a pad, and it's very, very, very difficult. And it's, in fact, something that you might want to devote a hobbyist attention to, and all of us are very busy. And often one senses an idea, this is a folk idea, that when you're teaching someone a language, then you're teaching them words. Oh, that it were that easy. So, darling, the word in Mohawk for aunt is this. Darling, the word in Mohawk for raise is this. But it doesn't work that way, as we've seen in this series. And as we know, if we've ever learned languages, there's grammar. We're talking about grammar as well as words. And it's grammar that's the hard part. If learning a language were a matter of taking 5,000 flashcards, laying them out on the floor in the garage, and just getting yourself to the point where you knew every word, we wouldn't have any problem. But if you're trying to help keep Mohawk alive, and there is such a movement, you've got a long way to go beyond teaching somebody the words, and the grammar is tough. And more to the point, opinions will differ as to what tough is, but we have to think about the fact that these languages are very, very, very different from English. So, for example, Mohawk is a fantastically interesting language, and there is a good, strong movement behind it to keep it from being eclipsed by larger languages such as English or French. And this is great, except when you're trying to teach somebody Mohawk, it's not just a matter of teaching them words, but it's a matter of dealing with a language where thoughts are put together in very different ways than English speakers are used to. In fact, counterintuitively different ways. So remember in Cayuga, it house bigs to her as an ordinary way of saying that she has a big house. That's weird. And that's just one of dozens of things. So, in Mohawk, let's take an English sentence like, suddenly she heard someone give a yell from across the street. Real simple. So, our sense of language, if we've learned European languages, is that it's going to be, she heard, and there's going to be some verb for heard, then there's going to be a word for someone, and then give a yell, where we're going to find, like, some word that means yell, and then from across the street. And so we're going to have some word for street, and the part about from across is actually kind of tricky no matter what language you're going to, but we'll figure it out, and we'll get a kind of a feel for it in German, the Sprachgefühl, and we'll be fine. No, in Mohawk, the way that sentence comes out, suddenly she heard someone yell from across the street, is suddenly, by what you could hear, there, it's beyond the street, the ear went to who just then may shouted back towards her. Now, if you learn what the words for all those things are, you're fine. But how would you intuit that that's the way that thought would be arranged? Suddenly, by what you could hear, and so not she heard, suddenly, by what you could hear, there, it's beyond the street. You need that it. Native American languages have a real it fetish. So it's beyond the street. then you didn't hear, the ear went to who just then kind of yelled. And so you have to know that it's going to be make a shout. There might not even be a word yell. Make a shout back towards her. That's hard. That's really difficult. And remember that that sentence is not an idiom. So it's not as if Mohawk has this one eccentric way of saying